I don't know if I even read the text correctly. I was kind of amused by his use of the word nature in relation to fate, and nature put this here, nature put that there. But I think he says something about how nature created the oceans. It had a lot of relevance to me, like kind of saying that God made the oceans and he made these natural separations between societies and nations. And yet we find a way to create a bond within those nations that are naturally separated, or create war within those nations. And right now they're talking about strangers and home. And then you asked about the border. I think it's interesting because while there are natural separations, there are also man-made separations, like the border that's here, that creates a force and strength. It makes of the people that are here strangers by force. You know, there's a Chicano text that talks about how the border made Chicanos and Mexicanos living in the U.S. strangers in their own home, so that this was once one nation and it was a home, and then because of the border and politics and nationality, they no longer belong here. You know, so then that creates a sense of chaos and war, because now, because of a paper or a wall or physical separation, it creates that chaos and anxiety.
I think in that particular context, and in many contexts, peace has been defined as nothingness, you know, as a state of nothing going on. And that's why in the graveyard, you know, may you rest in peace means may you, you know, have nothing going on with you, you know. And so I think in Que Descanse en Paz, all of those kinds of expressions are expressions that the ideal is to not have anything. It's a very interesting concept, because I think that peace, the way I relate to it, is not that. You know, it's the more the cessation of violence and hatred and abuse and all of those kinds of things. And there's different forms, because there's the state form, but like right now Mexico is going through a very violent war, but it has nothing to do with the state, you know, necessarily, other than the state is trying to eliminate the use of drugs, but the warring factions, these people decapitating those people, it has nothing to do with the politics or the geopolitical thing. It has to do with territory and you know, who's going to have it.
But I think it also does have to do a little bit with politics, because the leadership is so far removed from the border that some decisions that might be made outside of those areas are not necessarily thought through or have that kind of perspective of the local to be able to identify, well, really, how much good are we going to do versus how much damage, right, in fighting this. And I understand what you're saying. I think you're right, but I also think that that's been part of the frustration sometimes with the work of the border, is that locally we understand and we see the benefits and the exchanges and the goodness that can come out of projects, but it's so difficult because there are always these larger entities that form exemptions, and that land in the backyard of these locales. Well, I was thinking more about, as far as practice, I think what CASA really strives to do in providing a sort of sense of peace for families of this particular border community is that by trying to provide stability, and we hear it from the community members, you know, oh my goodness, I don't know what I would do without CASA, because now I am so much more either at peace or I have been able to deal with this emergency situation. And CASA, because we look at the being as a holistic person that can come with very complex issues, that it's not just a singular issue, that the engagement of that person or family or persons into as many things as GASA can provide kind of has a little bit of stability, if only for a moment, right, for whole families or for individuals. So I think the sense of stability is one that we try to really reach into those families. It's been very, very interesting to see that and to note that as we're trying to deal with the physical environment of what San Isidro is, that once we deal with the physical environment, there's still a lot of issues that might not necessarily make that a great place for somebody. And so I think talking about that in a way of trying to achieve really, really at the micro level pieces, that's part of the work. The other one is there's a different sense of hospitality, and it's still kind of a small town kind of feel. People will still walk down the street and say buenas tardes, con permiso, you know, and which is a little strange because it is between two such big urban giants, right? So, but there's still that sense, and the longevity of GASA's existence in the community has also allowed us to form that kind of sense of welcome. People will ask, you know, oh, no he visto Andrea, como la saluda, you know. So it's that kind of that stability, I think, that over a longer time has been provided for a bit more understanding and hospitality.
This week has been an unbelievable week, but we have hosted the ADL, the Anti-Defamation League, whose whole work is about trying to eliminate those points of contention and hatred between and amongst people, right? And when they were here and they commented on the photos, and part of GASA's philosophy of bringing an art gallery to a community that is as marginalized as we are, it's to expose our folks to art and different kinds of things, but it's also to round out and make softer their soul so that hatred doesn't find a place to grow. And that, unfortunately, is what I see right now in terms of the discourse on a global level, is that we have rigidified ourselves to the point where only hatred can grow, you know, and so we haven't softened ourselves to the system. We haven't let it into us so that it would create a more peaceful, a better environment where peace could thrive in a healthier way. And I think that if you look at just anywhere, just pick a place. Like, it's not just that lady in Pakistan. It's the lady in Juarez who's afraid to walk. It's the lady it's the Muslim in England. It's the, you know, it's all of these places where we have let ourselves become basically balkanized to the point of where people are in rigid silos and refuse or are not allowed to come out of those places.
You know, what's interesting in what you said, also the first comment that you made, it's almost like the way to prove that your hospitality is to have a stranger in your house, right? So it's almost like you bring it. So the way to be soft is to have these juxtapositions of soft and hard. If it was just soft, it would become mush, right? But it's almost like maintaining this. So it's almost like the border can keep it. Does the border keep it more alive? Does making those distinctions, versus that, you know, does it actually enliven the fact that strangers can talk to each other and find common ground?
How do you define hospitality in your life? Where do you find it?
I think I think it's just a sense of like making those like new in like your environment comfortable in that, or being sort of like a guide or like an usher or like a tour guide into your sort of culture, not necessarily like I think about my the sort like my grandmother, the way that, you know, people like she lived with us for most of my life, and they would come to our home and it wasn't just like, oh, like sit down and hello, but she would like cook something, even if it was really small and it took a few minutes, and then like not just that, but there would be like music or like conversation of some sort that was, you know, particular to our family, or just revealing part of sort of those like intimate spaces, I think. I think that that's sort of the way that my family demonstrates hospitality. It's like just giving you a peek of like, this is who we are, and you're welcome to look deeper or not.
Exposing that vulnerability,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think is part of the whole issue of the difference between being polite and being hospitable is that little cross when you let somebody see that you are a vulnerable person, you have vulnerabilities.
And I think that's interesting when discussing peace, because, I mean, revealing that kind of, that act of revealing vulnerability is predicated on this notion that, like, there will be no injury, there will be no assault on that.
Which is one of the reasons why I think that when David was saying that we're more rural than we are urban, I think in the urban setting, what we have found is for many, many reasons, we have pulled ourselves away and only let that intimacy be exposed with a very small percentage of folks. And therefore, you may know your neighbor, but you don't do anything with your neighbor, you know. And I think it's because of that. It's because of the fear that you will be somehow violated. Part of it is because you, even though in an urban setting you are dependent upon each other, it is it's kind of like the difference between overt and covert racism. You know, it's kind of like institutional racism versus the dogs kind of racism. And I think that that oftentimes is what you find. Rural settings, I think it's much more, it's closer to the surface, so that you can identify that, you know, you need your neighbors, or you need to all pull together to get through something. In a urban setting, because number one, because of their size, and because of the fact that we've buried it and buried it and buried it, we don't see that anymore.
We make it generic, right? Mm-hmm. So it's like anyone should be able to help each other on the street, but if you're in a rural setting, it's you, the person who lives in that corner and does this and does that. Right? There's much more specificity, mm-hmm, of identity, of agency.
I think that there is something about the kind of ephemeral moment where conflict is mediated, maybe without aspiring to the ultimate resolution, which might never arrive, but in that series of moments, you know, where encounters occur like that, the kind of mutual recognition, the momentary mutual recognitions of the rights of the stranger. This is in fact what, talking about Mexican culture, you know, the Benito Juarez famous dictum, which has become for all Latin America, is that peace, now I'm remembering, that peace is a respect for the stranger's rights, the ultimate peace. But anyway, this, but this mutual recognition is an interesting thing. And in relation to urban form for a moment, which there is something here interesting operating, at, because on one hand, there is a kind of more traditionalist view of the city as the recognizable urbis, whatever. And on the other, the more dislocated notion, which is the city as a place of moments of disorientation also that really produce levels of awakening and community, in fact, at times. But it's the border itself, because on one hand, I was remembering, you know, bringing back my memories of Greek, you know, philosophy in the context of the polis, that the city had to be composed of at least, what was it, like 5,000 people, I forget it, that everybody was to recognize each other. I mean, this is, that the agora was a place where the voice of the other would define the dimensionality of the place. And so, but that inspired many propositions of urbanization that really had to do with these enclaves that were limiting population that they had. So in other words, there is something to do with the rootedness of a community and its recognition, you know, that also that begins to produce potentially levels of protectionism and promote exclusion at some point. So I'm thinking of how to produce strategies of coexistence in that context. While you recognize the other, how do you then, you know, accept the other as well, as the other moves through momentarily? Part of the problem with, not the problem, but the issue with the border is that these communities are in flux. And so I guess in essence what I'm trying to say without complicating it is this conundrum, this contradiction. On one hand, the need for levels of permanency and rootedness, and on the other, how to enable also the kind of flow and the traffic and the movement of people.
This is where the biggest form of government touches the smallest form of community, and where the kind of in-betweens are just, they just kind of disappear almost.
And that's where stupidity emerges.
It's absolutely ridiculous.
We were talking...
It is pretty ridiculous.
We were talking a little bit about that this morning in one way or another in terms of the scales of the disillusionment with the state on one hand, the institutions at that, and then the formation of communities who become, in a sense, zones of generation of, you know, more, how would I call it? I'm thinking of this for a moment, resonance between hospitality, okay, when we can see it as this sort of happy moment of communion and da 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 da. But what about the hospitality where you are really open your vulnerability to accept the idiosyncrasies of the other, and in a moment of kind of, you take a risk basically, right? Because the policies that they are defining or describing from SANDA, which is this major entity, Association of Governments in San Diego, that really dictates the future of the border, is filled with stupidity. No risk whatsoever. It's about the kind of, let's resolve the problem, and the problem is about taking people, you know. And the risks are being taken by the kind of level of thinking that is happening at more, you know, micro levels of exchange and experimentation and so on. But this correspondence is an interesting thing, and how do we...
And maybe it has to do with, for us, it's just very personal. We have staff members that live in Tijuana because they can't afford to buy a house here or even some of the rents. So they live in Tijuana and they cross the border every other day or every day to come to work. We've gone through that experience either with family or ourselves about dealing with that issue of having to cross that border. When I was growing up, crossing back and forth in Juarez, I mean, it used to take me sometimes just 10 minutes. It was no big deal. And I could cross and use my driver's license, or I would go over and visit my grandma and she would make tacos for lunch, and I would spend some time with her and then come back. It was really no big deal. So I think that's been part of the maybe unwritten mission that we've been trying to work when we launched into dealing with the border project and trying to make sure that it's at least a good project, that we, for us, it's a lot more personal because of the people that we're really close to.
Yeah.
And if you start thinking about it as a hospitality issue, the officiousness of the border is not welcoming, mm-hmm. right? They treat you like you're a criminal coming across. Do you know that you're in custody? And I said, well, I may be in custody, but do I have to feel like I'm in jail, you know? I mean, because it's like Checkpoint Charlie coming through there, all right? And now on the Mexican side, they've come to the conclusion, well, you know what? You guys have sentry lanes, we're going to have sentry lanes, you know? You're using it to make money, we'll use it to make money. So now people who want to have more facility of crossing are going to have to pay money. And then that'll start separating people out too. And then also because of the guns and drugs and money, now the Mexicans have put up southbound interdiction. The United States also has planned for southbound interdiction. I said, well, what are you going to do? Put them at the front of the line? I mean, there is no... It's like ridiculousness, you know, taken to the nth degree. But all of those things address the whole issue of hospitality and of violence on a... Not violence of their hitting you, but... Hostility. If person who is crossing the border shows their paper, and the person they show their papers to just takes their crossing card, walks away, doesn't say to them, I'm going to go check on this, or I'll be back, excuse me, or I need to check on... No, they just walk away. This person is standing there. This is their livelihood, their jobs, all of these things. They don't even know what they did or how... You know, and if you get sent to secondary, sometimes you sit there because they're on a shift change, which takes one whole hour. You know, because they're over here jabbering to each other. Nobody comes out to say, "Well, we're on a shift change. You know, it'll be 15 minutes. Please bear with us." Nothing. No courtesies, no nothing. And that also adds to this feeling of I'm a human being. Can you at least treat me like me? One.
Dehumanizing. I mean, the one that we like to highlight the most is that for such a large activity of holding people, you know, in, because you're checking documentation, people can be waiting there for 3 or 4 hours and there are no public facilities, no restrooms that are open for people to do their business. So it really gets down to a very low level of dehumanization. It's pretty bad.
I always think of when people describe the process of crossing the border, I think of my dad. Because my dad was like an immigrant, but he's a citizen. But he still gets so nervous when he crosses the border. He's like, you cannot have a backpack because he's going to think that it has a bomb in it. And like he's going to think that he's going to get like pulled into secondary. And that kind of, he literally gets worked up and like anxious just crossing. And he's a citizen. He's been a citizen for like a decade now. Like it's ridiculous. Like, that he still feels that way.
It's conditioned fear.
Yeah, and I mean, it definitely has to do with the environment and like this notion of like the way that they ask you, like this very hyper authoritative military sense that I mean, just the actual facilities have, and then also just the way that people interact at the border. And one of the things that I also think is interesting of the space is that you do have like. You have 4 hours like moving along with thousands of people, but there's no interaction with anyone except for like with the radio. Like this notion of like the automobile as a very personal, private space in such a, what I think of such a public area of like infinite mobility, it seems, and there's no connection other than with like vendors, kind of. But it's a very interesting just space to think of this notion of like belonging, and I mean the example of my dad I think is also interesting because you have like this notion of even though you I guess officially stop being a stranger, like internalization of that feeling of being a stranger and never really belonging in a place, I think is also interesting and speaks to the lack of hospitality perhaps at that location, but also the way that the initial interactions and the initial, I guess, reception to people becomes internalized and becomes part of just the way that you experience the world, your environment.
And that you accept it. And you accept that that's the way it's going to be. Right,
right. And it's never going to change. And my dad's never going to get, like, stop being nervous, crossing the border. And like.
And what is secondary mean? It means that you've been pulled aside?
Yeah, it's like a separate division. Because I guess primary is the man who asks you for your papers at the actual like space. And then secondary is if he finds you shady or something.
Yeah, it's the secondary inspection point. Like
inspection
that's
point.
It's so secondary
like,
for sure.
Yeah.
Funny, I used to... Through all my times crossing, I would expect that I would be told to go to secondary 90% of the time. I would just expect that. And maybe I fit a profile that they were looking at, you know, this young looking guy, kid who has a car and so you know, crosses frequently, right? And when my ex-boss from Tucson, as an architect, Corky, Teddy and Andrea know him, he's like, well, what do you mean they always pull you into secondary? I said, yeah, you know, I just come to expect it. And he's like, well, that's ridiculous. They never pull me into secondary. I mean, I crossed many times, right, over in Nogales. And for one trip, we brought a group of students, and Teddy gave them a tour of the border area. I said, okay, so watch. We got off the van, and we all walked as pedestrians to cross and then reload in the van. They checked every single student and his documents. And they got to me, and they say, okay, hold on. And he was like, well, how did that happen? You know, but it's a really strange, I mean, it just, you don't feel like you're belonging here or there. Going through college, I had the same feeling of, I went to elementary school in Mexico, and I started my last year of elementary school in the States, and then finished college. I never felt comfortable with my English, and when I was finally at architecture school, I went through an experience where we had a foreign exchange group from Mexico, from La Salle, and it was the first time I was told. My Spanish was not good enough, you know? So I was like, so then I was like, wait a minute. So you know, so there is that moment of self-realization. Okay, so good along here. Finally, towards finishing architecture school, I recognized and I realized that the understanding of the two languages, the two cultures, the exchanges of money, and the way that families worked along the border was an actual benefit that could be used to expand and do work in those communities. And so that's one of the reasons why I decided after finishing school that I wanted to work in the border community, because I recognized that the level of knowledge and or exploration with design and architecture and community issues was just not really happening. And so that kind of, you know, channel. That's where I channeled my energies, and that's what I've been doing here. The other kind of moment that when I was reading through this, it gets down to a very personal level of forming community. Is I remember as a kid feeling very much at peace in the neighborhood that we used to live in Juarez, and maybe because we knew there was a really good connection with a lot of the neighbors around there, that when it rains really hard and the streets get flooded, it washes all of the sediment right down to the streets. And I remember this one moment where my dad told me, come on, let's see what we can do about this. So we went outside, and he went and knocked on doors and borrowed shovels and buckets and whatever, and he organized a group of men to come out And we cleared, you know, I was there, whatever I could do, we cleared that corner of all of the mud that was there. That would have taken months for the municipality to come and do. And that kind of action, I still believe, is one that is still working in those colonias and neighborhoods, and that at the border particularly, if we figure out a way to connect those energies, don't necessarily have to depend on a top-down kind of action.
Are there any other anecdotes that anybody wants to share?
If I could just say something about the idea of hospitality, because here I would say that hospitality is perhaps a detour, because we were talking about how in the interaction with the other, right, that there is this anxiety, right? And that ultimately that anxiety, which then turns into enthusiasm or the recognition of your position or your difference with the other, is ultimately a position that's derived from fear. And I think that it's important to acknowledge that this fear comes out of a class imbalance. I mean, one of the words that I think are completely absent from all of the discussion is the issue of class, right? And I only want, you know, to put this out there because the problem is also not the particular antagonisms that exist. It's precisely like, it's the public that conditions the private, these private antagonisms, right? That ultimately we have to, in a way, localize production as a way of abolishing that kind of class imbalance that's happening. And this is not something that, I mean, and perhaps that's even a better definition than peace, or a better word than peace would be the abolition of a place in which any kind of class system could exist, right? Rather than using the term peace, because I think peace still exists at the level of acknowledging all these differences, which is what creates a lot of the problems, you know. But if other people want to go ahead. Did that make sense?
It makes, you know, I think what happens is that class has a weird history in itself, and it, and it's mixed here with so many other things. So it's almost like you exchange one kind of distinction for another that has its own imports. And is it easier to abolish strangeness of ethnic background, of class, of right?
I was really kind of fascinated by the move towards health and health problems as the mode by which you're able to capture the attention of federal level concern for a local issue that's clearly much more complicated than, you know, pollutants in the strict sense of how they could be measured in the air and in the lungs and stuff like that. But I think it's kind of fascinating that, you know, the problem of the border on so many levels seems to be registered on the body. Right, like the nervousness or the ways in which bodies can move and not move, and which bodies can and can't move, and yet somehow another version of the body, one that can be counted in this one way, or that can spread beyond the control of choice at the border, becomes the moment that you get attention. I don't know, like it's like you have to, then you think about like the universality of human rights that Kant wants to pull up as a kind of rational principle, but in fact it's not going to be human rights, it's going to be human health, or in some other way another mode of contamination. Like, we wouldn't want our own systems of control to produce another kind of contamination, because the whole, obviously the border is about not being contaminated by one people. And yet it produces another kind of pollutant that's contaminating our own people. And, you know, at a metaphorical level, you think about fear and hatred and all these divisions that seem like causes of the kind of progressive left traditionally, and yet they're being registered as a health concern now. But But it would be interesting if you could then take that route and move through the problem of, you know, airborne pollutants into the problem of, like, psychological pollutants and and health at the level of the psychic health of a community. Like, could it slowly, out of that one little crack of health, grow into a broader vision of health? And this is sort of related to something you brought up earlier, how, in fact, the idea of health has changed. It used to be the absence of
disease,
and now it's a more where there's more and more a holistic vision, which even you guys talked about. And so that was the idea of maybe how peace could work, that it would become a more holistic vision of peace through all these. But I just that to me, that was so surprised to hear that suddenly that was like the moment at which a kind of fissure arises where you can possibly access the kinds of attention and funding and things that will make your own initiatives.
And it's almost as if we're saying you have a right to be healthy. That maybe that's becoming a universal.
Yeah, exactly.
That's the discussion, right?
Yeah,
so, okay, so then we can enter it through that.
But I do think that, you know, there's handbooks on how to scare people when you're law enforcement. I mean, you can only operate inside of certain restrictions. And there's, I guess, the NAACP publishes a lot of that stuff and shows.
Yeah, and the Border Patrol has their own. Like, I've seen them. My uncle works at the port of entry, not here in San Diego Tijuana, but in Calexico, Mexicali, which is, like, in right, like, next to Arizona, I would say, but still at the California border. So, I thought it was also really interesting discussing health, because it made me think of, I think 11th grade or something, I read for the first time Borderlands, La Frontera, which is this work by Gloria Anzaldúa, who is a Chicana like poet and theorist and stuff. And I think the quote is like that the border is an open wound where the first world rubs against the third and like bleeds. So, like, I believe that is the exact. And I remember feeling so uncomfortable and almost offended at that quote, because I certainly didn't feel like I had grown up in a place that was bleeding in any way. I felt like I had grown up in a place that was nuanced in its cultural expressions, and like that it was, but definitely this. Like that connection to the body, and almost like this place is a place of pathology. It's not. It's almost like this impossibility of sanity and of like even bodily health that was really, really troubling to me, because I felt like she was the one, you know, that had written this, and this is a woman who also grew up in the border, and I just felt like making that experience of the border so like singular was unfair to the border in a way. And like I hadn't crossed here in Tijuana like many times, like maybe 3 or 4 times in my entire life, until I crossed with Misael, and then like we'd been working on projects in Tijuana, so we'd cross more frequently. And I also noticed that, I wanted to bring this up earlier, but I felt like it was off topic. The experience of crossing here, because of just like how huge like the port of entry is, and just like the amount of cars, and like it's so different from the crossing I had been accustomed to. Just like, I mean, first of all, there's only like 3 lanes or 4 lanes or something when you're crossing. Because, well, ironically, Mexicali is like the capital of Baja California, but it's located in the middle of like a scorching desert. So it's like 120 degrees in the summertime. So like nobody really wants to cross under these conditions, but do. So I had associated like heat, like just like being near dehydration, like just to move across to like see my grandma or whatever. But it was fine. Like I didn't feel that sense of intimidation necessarily when going through. And I don't know if it's just because it's a smaller community, and like I said, like my uncle is in charge of some of these people. So once like somebody really mistreated my grandmother, like just were really rude to her and like took her papers and she had to wait there for like an hour and she had a headache. So then the same day, like my uncle called him and reprimanded him and told him like, well, like who do you think you are to like treat people's mother that way and shape up. So then, like, and so then he apologized, and he, like, sent my grandmother flowers, and created, and I just think it's, like, that the crossing here is just that. It's, like, a movement, it becomes a movement of bodies instead of, like, this movement of people.
And there's
of
no, what you described is accountability in Mexicali, right? On an individual basis. And here, again, it's this generic mass, right? So everyone kind of, on average, has to behave okay or not right?
But
the less human you are as you cross, the less problems you will have. The more human you are, if you have a personality and you express it in your clothes or you express it with your mouth, for Pete's sake, you are at risk. And just like he gets stopped. We were teasing in the car the other day when we went down to the estuary. We said, because the Border Patrol was coming, he said, oh, there goes David.
Yeah.
You know, because...
they were in the vans and I was following in my own vehicle. And,
and I said, oh, no, here he goes. And I won't cross the border with my husband because I know it's an automatic go to secondary. And he's an Anglo person, but he says American citizen with such...
Disdain
that they just sent him over. And I said, I am not, I'll get out of the car and go with someone else. Or cross walking because I said, oh no. And so, but there are actual things that they look at. Like if you're a man, your Adam's apple, if it starts jiggling, and all of those kinds of things, they have like symptomologies of like...
Yeah, or if you like look up into the corner, that's, I don't remember which corner, but you're trying to recall a visual memory, so then you might be trying to lie. So then...
Well, and some of these things are cultural, you know, we're taught in the Latino culture that you do not look at authorities in their eyes. Out of respect, you lower your eyes. Well, in America, you're taught, you look at me when you're talking to me. Because if you're not looking at me, there's something wrong with you. You know, you're trying to get one over on me. So our kids go through that all the time when they're stopped by enforcement agencies, of which we have 11 just in our community. Besides the police and Border Patrol, we have ATF, DEA. I mean, it goes on forever. So the kids who are adolescents, who are, you know, I mean, that's a very special place to be anyway. If they're stopped by the police, where were you? Nowhere. What do you mean you were nowhere? And look at me when I'm talking to you. And they're trying to show deference by not looking at them, and all of those kinds of things then play into that scenario. But you were talking about health. I think maybe part of it is that becoming ill or being affected by pollution is nothing. We do not have control over that. And it is something that affects everyone. If you're like secondary smoke, if you're not smoking, but you can be affected by it, right? And I think that maybe health is that generic or place where we can all be impacted by what is happening on this border. So I think that might be one of the ways to help organize around it, but it also is one of the biggest fears. And that's why it becomes an attention grabber. Because, you know...
We kind of learned to... But what's changed about health is that we've learned to track to the source and have something, hold someone accountable. So we can tell by the pollutants if they're coming from trucks or if they're coming in. So suddenly this thing that in other situations make you invisible because you're generic, now you can maybe hold someone accountable, and it makes people feel responsible. So it's a strange way to kind of get empowered, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But in another way, that disempowers the idea of as health as a metaphor for harm, like a harmful situation, like isolating it to its source means like, oh, well, blame the source, fix the source, stop the source, and then like whatever the peace situation we're talking about has no chance to kind of like reach people who don't live in this area. Like, you know, I don't know, I'm going to backtrack and say, like, I think it's interesting that one of the things everybody talks about is the personal and the power of the personal, and really like I think about like that we each cite personal examples like from our own life experiences, and we don't talk about other people when we try to relate to things. And like, I was sitting here because I was first sitting here doing this too, and thinking about my mother and how my mother is like a really amazing and sweet person, but she's also like totally racist, and I wouldn't describe her as a good person, you know, like, which is, I know it's kind of off color to disparage your parents, but like,
we all do it, we just don't do it in public.
Yeah, but you know, in fact, like, on that level, like, my mom was really a wonderful person when she's face to face with people, like, and I think she's genuine and sincere, and she's never smarted me as anything otherwise, you know, but in private, like, the way my parents talk is kind of abominable, you know, but I think it's very interesting that my mom, if she met any number of people, she would be a good person, like, in their company, and then when she goes home, she takes these other ideas that she has, and, like, removes the people she's met from that situation, and continues to, you know, to espouse really horrible things, you know, but there's something about that as the power of the personal, and the personal story has always been kind of a beacon in any kind of progressive movement, you know, like you name the victim and you say this is who they are and this is why it's important that we help them. Where was I going with this? I'm not sure. Oh, but I guess like depoliticizing, you know, the metaphorical idea of health and harm and how a political situation is engendering and reproducing kind of malevolent attitudes, you know, in the long run, it would be unfortunate, I think. You know, I guess that's I guess
it's almost like displacing.
Yeah, you know, you're like, okay, we can solve the problem, but like nobody wants the metaphor. You know, nobody wants the kind of like, well, this is an allegorical situation. It's like going to art to find a solution for problems. You know, nobody wants to do that. It's like you go to art to enjoy you know, the entertainment of art. You don't like, nobody watches a Hollywood movie to think about how, you know, Bruce Willis is a misogynist and Die Hard. You know, they watch Bruce Willis so he'll blow up crap, you know. I don't know. It's just, like, at the end of the day, I'm wondering like how like, we actually harness, you know, health as a metaphor for harm and like and proceed forward. Because one of the things I think a lot about when I think about peace, and we talked yesterday, or you spoke yesterday, kind of about, you know, talking about peace is really like an absurd pedagogical exercise that, you know, is essentially futile in a lot of ways. But like, when I think about peace, the only thing I think about is like how do we prevent harm from, you know, how do we stop harming people, you know? Like, at the end of the day, like, is this, like, fundamental to our, you know, species? Is this, like, a species endemic problem? You know, like, all species are violent towards, you know, their own kind and others. Like, you know, is this something specifically, you know, is this, like, an unsolvable situation? Like, if the question then becomes, like, how do we live, you know, how do we coexist in a world? I don't know if it was Teddy saying or you saying yesterday about, like, okay, we've got, oh, no, it was in one of the videos you showed, but, like, about, you know, okay, we're all on this land, like we share like the earth together. Like, how do we actually share it and not constantly battle for power position? You know, I think it's something like Ari was saying, like, you know, how class, you know, class is. I'm trying to string everything that everybody's saying together, and I should really just stop. You know, get thinner and thinner as I go.
But, you know, there's something that you, so in this kind of stringing, I think what you hit upon is that you can take the same thing and you can use it to change a conversation, to enlarge it, to problematize it. You can also use it to kind of tuck things away and hide them under the the cup, right? Mm-hmm. And you have to stay alive to say, if I'm an artist now, this day and age, in this place, is there something I could do to stay alive or to make the life around me, right?
Well, as a cynic and a pessimist, you know, the question that I've kind of reduced myself to isn't like, how do you affect change, but how do you retain hope?
Yeah.
You know, like, which blows my mind, like, to sit at a table of people or, you know, to view anybody talking about having hope. I'm like, okay, how do we continue to do that? Like, if you look at history, you just glance at history, that we have, like, you know, thousands of years of documented human history, and it seems like everything we're talking about is just, like, variations on a cycle, you know? Like, in which case, like, how do you know, everybody, you know, I get a lot of flack for being the cynic and pessimist that I am, but, like, but at the same time, I kind of, I'm like, okay, well, how do you do what you're doing? How do you be optimistic? How do you get up in the morning and say, things are going to go well today? Like, you know, you look at the news, or you read a book, and all of a sudden you're like, well, this is like the same thing we were doing 100 years ago, 1,000 years ago. And that's just us. Like,
what's your name?
Sorry, I'm Lewis.
Lewis. Well, one thing, you're young, all right? That's probably why people are amazed at your cynicism, right? Because when you get old, they go, oh, yeah. My husband's favorite saying is, let no good deed go unpunished. I mean, it's because that's what, you know, that's his philosophy of the world. It's like, it doesn't matter what, how good you are, you know, it'll whip back on you and become a negative experience. But maybe with health and environmental, you know, like the global warming kinds of things, because it is so pervasive, all right, maybe it gives us a foundation upon which we can build, because it, you know, health, it doesn't matter your station in life or your economic class or none of those things, your ethnicity, none of those things are impacted. Now, it might be, I don't know, but it might be harder for some ethnicities some ethnicities are prone to some, you know, diseases, but all people can get them. All right, there's no one is immune to respiratory.
What? No one is immune to global warming.
Well, that's right, and it's like we can start up some way to help ease the situation with global warming, but if we don't involve the entire world in that effort, it won't matter what we do. Because it will become so big that it will overwhelm the world, you know.
So many interesting notions or interpretations began to appear. You know, and I guess, of course, that's, I imagine, the ultimate sort of intention of some of these exchanges, that while we look at peace over there, right, as this sort of aspiration that is almost unattainable, let's say, for a moment, sounded a bit fatalistic or whatever, but the obsession with attaining that has been not only the, at times, the utopian failure, okay, or the sort of forceful way of arriving to that, but instead of dwelling on the kind of detours that somehow need to be engaged, you know. And I'm thinking one of those detours, at least I'm thinking in my mind, some of the interesting notions that appear, one having to do with the production of conflict, the production of ignorance, of fear, particularly, of inequality. And I'm thinking already of those as spaces of operation that really respond once more to this issue of the experiential, because I think the mediating factor here, at least having been come here to expand on the conversation, when you said, you know, it gets personal, right, at some point. I'm thinking the production of fear, for example, in many of the anecdotes that Andrea shares at times, defining the kind of physicality of this environment is really about retreat. It's about, you know, lack of ownership or engagement, and then somehow you begin to retreat into your internal cocoon, but not only that, you put a bar window, how do you call that, you know?
Yeah.
And this is, on the other end, the production of fear that produces the other city that we know, that is also made of regulation that really separates things constantly. And I'm now going back to La Jolla, where in fact there is not bars on the windows, but there are these wonderful, you know, open spaces where the person, as Andrea says, not only owns the house but owns the damn yard on the other side.
Oh, no. And owns your
but then is conditioned also by the kind of rejection of the other and the kind of. So I'm thinking, I mean, how at some point this sort of meandering back up forth, this sort of elastic sort of consideration, you know, how to deal on one end with the institutional stupidity that has not been absent from the experiential kind of commonsensical vicissitude that really shapes, you know, the once more the everyday practices of an environment like this. Well, like Anuradha Mathur, the landscape architect, said about being so pissed off that we keep talking about this this year, natural disaster after natural disaster. There is no such thing as natural disasters, and the disasters happen when the stupidity of development collides with the logics of nature. And it is in that sort of, you know, rupture, you know, between the institutional protocols that have perpetuated conflict out of their absence from the kind of individual or personal, at times, experiential conditions that would allow maybe the city to be, maybe I'm thinking now the production of risk as another detour, because an urbanism that is counterintuitive to institutions will be one that is open to risk, to porosity, to interpenetration, to, you know what I mean? But it would be seen as dangerous. So enabling, again, this elastic thing between the familiar and the unfamiliar, too. I mean, so.
And then, in terms of fear and hatred and all of that, I think one of the things that we have to understand is that it is a process. It is a process. And one of the things that, one of the places that it really hit me, and I've gone back several times, is in the Holocaust Museum in New York City, when they talk about how graphics were used to perpetuate the hatred of the Jewish people, and how the print that they decided to use, and the colors and the size of the letters and the bulk and then the caricatures of the people and all of that kind of stuff, how all of that, one piled on top of the other, produced, it took sane people and allowed them to act in insane ways. Now that the leaders were insane, that's a given, but that they were able to motivate an entire country to take up their issue is
or maybe even not motivate, but make it acceptable for
right.
the individuals to participate in that, right? Because
right.
you could say a lot of them experienced, I just joined the youth, I just joined the whatever, right? I just did what, but it was acceptable. And the work that goes on culturally for gun violence to be acceptable for, right, and it does the icons, the language, right?
Right, and I mean, I hold out hope that if we can teach, I call them the rank and file people, right? If you can teach the rank and file people the process so that when they are being bombarded with it, they can decipher it. Then their choices become much more meaningful, because and they can. I am convinced because we've taught them things about urban form that that they only teach you in colleges, right? And we've taught that to the lady who makes the bed at the Holiday Inn, for Pete's sakes, you know, and she can talk to you in her language. And then you need to she's talking about mixed use. But what she's talking about is how you would build, because we've given them these exercises. Well, if you could redo this boulevard, how would you do it? And they naturally come up with a mixed use formula, right? And then we tell them, oh, well, you know what? When you're talking to architects and planners, people about the fine grain and blah, blah, blah. I said, they call that mixed use. Oh, and is that what they call it? Because otherwise we're talking two different languages. But I really feel that, and that's one of the things that we do, is we demystify the process for them by explaining it to them and giving them examples.
So probably that's one topic. I have to keep going, but this issue of visualization of the production of these registers, of conflict, of inequality, of ignorance. I mean, this is still based on what you were saying. You were saying that in a country where, what is it, 2 to 5% of the population own 80% of the resources, we still see it as a classless or as a kind of a place where equity reigns. Yeah.
But but
so the visualization, or you know, or the other day when after the killings in Arizona, you know, there are lines to really, you know, to the exponential of sale. What is the sale of the gun?
The guns went up.
So what is it about this like invisibility?
Or after
the so the visualization of these conflicts and processes. I mean, the process itself. Is more important than the aspiration to peace as an objective, that the detours that allow us to station ourselves, which goes back to the spaces of operation, you know, to these momentary instances of you know, negotiation or mediation of conflict. I mean, across those many of these registers.
Well, and if you talk about part of it is the system that we've chosen, the private property system that we've chosen, and that you have the right to defend your property because that is your castle, and that you have the right to take a gun and shoot anybody who's trying to come into your castle. And the indigenous people didn't have those kinds of thoughts. They thought the earth was here, and you use the earth, and you respect the earth, but you couldn't own it because it was the earth, you know, and the earth owned you, as opposed to you owning the earth, and the earth gave birth to you, and so it's just a kind of like a different idea about how of who the individual is. What we have adopted in a thing that we, the human beings, are the most important animal on the earth. Why? Because we decided that that was true. Who knows? It might be the number one. I don't think that I'm any more valuable than a honeybee, you know. And but I can tell you, I'm in the north.
You know. Yeah. Well, now you know why Andrea is a matriarch of San Isidro. But what I've learned in this relating to the topic precisely is working here is how to build strategies of coexistence and tolerance. You know, I think that at the end it has been an incredible, at least for me, a kind of set of procedures that transcend a kind of very one-dimensional punctual type of, you know, terms that we turn us off, enabling a conversation, which is part of what we're trying to do.